Hey, Coach. Welcome to the Basketball Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Oliver. Let's share the game.
Hey, Coach, I'm excited to announce a brand new way to access our resources to elevate your coaching monthly memberships. At Basketball Immersion, we know every coach's journey is unique, just like your player's skill sets. That's why we're dedicated to providing you with the flexibility you crave. Our new monthly access plan lets you get full access to all our videos and courses on a month-to-month basis, giving you the freedom to cancel or renew as needed. Whether you're just starting out or looking to add some fresh perspectives to your existing coaching repertoire, Basketball Immersion has the resources to help you reach your goals. Head over to basketballimmersion.com to take control of your coaching journey and unlock your full potential with Basketball Immersion.
Awesome to welcome NBA G League head coach Dylan Murphy to the Basketball Podcast. Dylan Murphy is the head coach of the Osceola Magic, the NBA G League affiliate of the Orlando Magic. Dylan Murphy has been associated with the Orlando Magic for the past five seasons. His journey began as a basketball operations analyst from 2018 to 2020, where he provided valuable analytics support to the coaching staff. Prior to joining the Magic, Murphy served as an NBA G League scout for the Atlanta Hawks during the 2016-17 season. From 2013 to 2016, Murphy worked as assistant coach for the Fort Wayne Mad Ants, the NBA G League team for the Indiana Pacers. Murphy also served as a graduate assistant for the men's basketball team at Ball State University in 2018. Dylan, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's going to be fun to talk to you. And let's start off with, maybe can you share what handling coaching analytics for Coach Clifford and the Orlando Magic involved when you first started with Orlando?
Yeah, so it was a lot of things, but I think the job of anybody in a basketball organization is to add value. And so for me, finding ways to leverage data, not just to describe what was going on, but be prescriptive, offer solutions, offer insights that coaches could take on the court versus to say, hey, we rank 9th in this, 11th in this. That's good information, but what do we do with that information? So it was constantly trying to take that next step so the coaches didn't have to take that step themselves. And one of the things that I always tried to do is to encourage our coaches to ask basketball questions instead of data questions. And I'll provide a data answer, but rely on me to understand the data, to know what you're actually looking for versus you as the coach search for the statistic. That was my area of expertise. They would ask the question, hey, what's the best pick and roll coverage to use against this team? And I would answer that from a data perspective versus where does this team rank in drop coverage? What are you really trying to ask? So that was the big steps I took with my job and trying to make sure I could help our staff in any way I could.
I love that approach. That to me would work for me personally too. Not being, again, an expert with all the data, as I'm imagining many coaches aren't. Is this a very common position now that exists throughout the NBA? And is it a little bit more throughout college as well now?
Yeah, I'm not sure about college, but I know in the NBA, basically every team has someone that fills that role. It was a little different for me because after 2 years, I got added to Coach Cliff's staff as an assistant. So I was doing that, but also doing our analytics. And that was still my main role. So it's a hybrid role. Some teams do it where you're part of the front office and you do some coaching analytics work as an aside to help. Some teams, they're coaching analytics persons on the coaching staff. Some teams, they're just embedded with them, but not on the coaching staff. So how it's set up is different across the league. But I think as the game changes and as the resources in the NBA get bigger and bigger, teams want every minuscule advantage they can get. So they're obviously, analytics is one area where there's been a lot of growth.
We'll ask some analytics questions. We'll dive deep into some basketball coaching ideas. But maybe just as you said that, it triggered me a little bit. Like, we've always talked about, like, being a video guy is one of the best ways to get entry into the NBA. Is this another great way to get entry into the NBA, is understanding the analytics and being able to work in whether the analytic department or other?
For sure. I would say most of the analytics people get pulled from other industries, because they have certain data science skills or whatever skill set, building websites, all that kind of stuff. And they also have basketball knowledge. I think like any job, if you have the skill set, we can teach you the context around it versus you might know basketball, but if you can't program, then it's obviously not really helpful for an analytics department. But it's funny for me, like I started in coaching. I only picked this up just as you put it, to get into the MBA, it was, hey, here's this opportunity. Would you be willing to learn how to code and take some data knowledge you have and combine it with the basketball knowledge you have? And I said, where do I sign? And just been riding the journey from there. But for sure, it's every team's analytics department is growing. There's more and more opportunity every year.
Yeah, it's such a lot of younger people are growing up with this, whereas I, for example, much older, would have to learn this, and they're growing up with it. So obviously, it's just going to keep expanding as we move forward. Look, I know when I ask you an analytics question, so much of it is, it depends. It depends on so many factors, right? Like your personnel, who you're playing, et cetera, et cetera. Beyond threes worth more than two and free throws and the value of the rim attempts, what are some certainties that we can say from an analytics standpoint?
I think one of the biggest misconceptions is the rim is significantly more valuable than any other spot on the floor. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but when you include free throws, drive to the rack, get fouled in the restricted area, you're talking about 1.3, 1.35 points per possession. Whereas like your average corner three, let's say you shoot 38%, so you're going to be at 1.14. So that's a 20 points per 100 possession difference from a corner three to a driving layup. So the idea that three is greater than two, I would change it to three is greater than long two. But close two is still better than three. That's something that we're always driving home. You want to get to the rack and protect the rim. It's like the two staples. Now, how you do that, obviously, that, now that gets into coaching questions of spacing and the offense and defense you run and all that. But if you're talking about just a pure where do we point our sword, it's the rim is the main thing we're trying to attack and protect.
I'm glad. That's great phrasing, by the way, that I'll start to use. But when we're starting, let's say you started your season with the G League team, do you start in terms of designing your tactics from an analytics standpoint, or do you start from the roster standpoint?
Yeah, we start from a Orlando Magic standpoint first, where Jamal Mosley, our head coach, installing his offense and defense, but he's a very forward-thinking person, and he embraces analytics and embraces the value. So I'd probably say it starts just from a value standpoint, like, you achieve the goals is dependent on personnel, but what you're trying to achieve doesn't change, if that makes sense. So that's the approach I would say that we take in Orlando.
And you mentioned obviously transitioning. You started with this role and then you moved into kind of a player development focus with the Magic, and obviously a full assistant focus is the Magic. From those perspectives, then, what do you feel is maybe one of the things that best drives player development in terms of connecting these two things together, analytics and obviously your experiential knowledge as a basketball coach?
Yeah, I know you guys are big on motor learning. I am too. I think there's been a lot of really smart work done in that area from a development standpoint. And so you can combine those things in a bunch of different ways. Most NBA teams now have the NOAA cameras in their gyms. What you can learn from depth of shot, arcs, all of that to drive development, and then to drive how you implement that development using random practice with the NOAA cameras. So you can, I always think about it like we're using the data to tell us where to go, and then we're using the principles of motor learning for how to get there. And the tricky part then is like, how do you incorporate data in a way that's like not overwhelming to a player? Or do you even bring it up to a player? Like, how do you handle all that? We allow the data to set a direction, but we don't really overwhelm players with data. And if we are going to present data, it's because it's so obvious what's being presented that it's driving home the point in the way we want it to drive home. And we're leaving the nuance behind when it comes to if things aren't as clean and clear, and we rely on our smart people to tell us where the nuance is pointing us. But when we're presenting that data, especially from a development standpoint, hey, you need to work on X, Y, or Z. If it's not crystal clear, then we won't present it because we don't feel like it's maybe muddying the waters in a way we don't want it to.
I'm glad you mentioned that. And let's use NOAA as an example. And you talked about it's driving a little bit of the decision-making, but we don't want to overload the player.
So when it comes to something like NOAA, does it give you this detail about preferred shot location for a player? And then does that drive a little bit of the tactics about where to put that player within offensive schemes?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I hadn't thought of it like that. My instinct, and this is not super well thought out, so I'll apologize in advance, but my instinct is I'm not sure how much can be derived from specific player locations, like they're better shooting from this spot or another. I think shot distance is going to carry a lot more weight than shot location, if that makes sense. So like a 19 footer versus a three, as opposed to a left wing three versus a right wing three. Obviously, they're always going to be outliers, but I would say the average player, it's probably not the case. I'm thinking more with the NOAA data specifically. And there's some stuff that we've done a lot of research here in Orlando, which got to keep that one a little private, but using that to drive how we want to adjust a player shot in a way that is consistent with what we all know about motor learning. We're not going to be like overly technical, external focus, all that kind of stuff. So again, just thinking about, we use our analytics department to help us digest the data and set a direction. And then we use what we know about coaching and building those relationships to implement. But yeah, that's an interesting idea. I've never really personally used the NOAA in that way.
It just came up as we were talking, but I love your blended approach. Like it makes sense to me in terms of connecting those two things. And I think that it tends to be actually from a skill acquisition motor learning perspective that we're not connecting as much as the data seems ahead, whereas a lot of programs, a lot of teams, for example, are not connecting as much from a skill acquisition perspective. But I know Orlando is doing that. Another thing that gets asked a lot when it comes to analytics, and I know this is a buzzword, is pace. Obviously, we talk a lot about pace. I know offensive scoring is up in the NBA, for example. But beyond just pace, how can coaches leverage analytics to optimize offensive tempo? And let's throw shot selection in, since we talked about that a little bit right there as well.
Yeah, with the pace, I know we found in the past that pace basically has no relationship with offensive efficiency. Mm. If you think about the best offenses in the league, it's walk the ball down, throw it to Kevin Durant in the post and make a bunch of shots. And that's like the slowest offense in the league, but also probably the most efficient. Right? It's James Harden, walk the ball up in Houston. Dribble, step back three, pick and roll, lob, but they weren't going up and down at 100 miles an hour. That's a part of it for sure, that like great players tend to play slower because they're trying to set up offense. LeBron plays slower. I'll use us as an example. So Osceola, we were second in pace in the first half of the season and we were very efficient offensively. Now we're like 16th in pace in the second half and we're more efficient than we were before. So you play to the tempo of your players. If you have guys that play well playing fast, play fast. But if you have guys that play well playing slow, play slow. Shot locations are efficient, not the timing of it right now. Like you're more likely to get a transition layup if you run early in the clock. But like the average transition three is a below average half court shot. So yeah, if you get an open transition three, great. But if you just run down and shoot a transition three, it's a bad shot, both from a team psychological perspective, obviously, just like someone runs down and takes a pull-up 31 footer, and it's inefficient. I'm not sure. Pace is just dependent on who you've got. That's each coach's discretion.
It's fascinating. And I'll just end that part of the conversation with, obviously, the shot clock takes care of to a certain extent, pace as well within the NBA and within the rest of the world that plays FIBA rules. And obviously, there's high schools that don't play with a shot clock. So that probably has more of a factor with pace. If you were putting on your high school hat a little bit in terms of that, what would you think about some of those teams that play like super slow? Is it just a question of finding the right shot?
Yeah, there's so many like int factors. If we play slower, the other team's more likely going to play a little bit slower. And if we have a good defense, then that's probably going to help us. So it's not just like offense is living, it's like own organism on one end of the floor. If you have a shot clock, obviously NBA 24 second shot clock, we got to get to it right away regardless. But it doesn't necessarily mean if you have no shot clock, playing super slow is also good or bad. You might play super slow and eventually frustration sets in and someone just going to shoot a bad shot. Who has the patience to play offense for 45 seconds and pass it around to wait for a good shot? Like, eventually someone's going to get impatient. Yeah, there's a lot of pieces to it, but I just go back to pace is just dependent on your roster, your rules, what you think is good for your team. But I know just from my own research, pace really doesn't carry a lot of weight from an efficiency standpoint. Obviously, the Sacramento Kings play super fast and they're super efficient. That's great for them, but there are a lot of fast teams in the NBA that are super inefficient. So I would argue Sacramento is efficient because they have great players, not because they play super fast.
And you connected that for us before with the different types of players as well. So I love that. Another curiosity for me has always been like the most effective strategies for maximizing offensive efficiency against different types of defenses. And in the past, obviously, used to be very man-to-man heavy, player-to-player heavy in the NBA. But now there's obviously a little bit more variability with zone and different things like that. So is there anything that you can share with us about different types of efficiencies versus different types of defenses?
Yeah, there's a lot in this area. Obviously, different pick and roll coverages incite different efficiencies, zone, all of that. I will say, though, without kind of drilling down too deeply, I think one of the fundamental questions you have to define first is when you say something is efficient or inefficient from a coverage standpoint, like I'll just take like a drop coverage, for example. So let's say I'll use my point guard on Osceola. Mac McClung comes off a pick and roll, angle pick and roll. He whips it to the opposite corner. The low man's pulled it in, but then the low man sprints and closes out and we're unable to shoot a corner three. The ball gets swung. Now it's reset, a new pick and roll comes. So what happened on that first pick and roll? I think we'd all agree a pick and roll occurred, but it wasn't efficient or inefficient, right? There was just no shot, so there's no result. But I think any coach would say that was a good defensive possession, right? The low man was in, he sprinted to the corner, he took the shot away. So that should be a stop. So when you're measuring efficiency of that pick and roll, you're both measuring when there is a quote-unquote direct outcome, like the pick and roll led to a shot, what was the efficiency of that? But also, how often is a shot generated from that pick and roll? So you can have someone who's like super high efficiency when they get a shot at a pick and roll, but they're unable to get a shot very frequently. So maybe that's a guy in the last 8 seconds, you look at his number and you're like, he's very efficient in pick and roll, but the shot frequency is only 60% of the time. Then that means 40% of the time we're getting a shot clock violation. So that's not efficient. So we'd probably want him handling earlier in the shot clock. Later in the clock, we don't want to give him the ball because he can't as reliably create a shot, right? And then the later in the shot clock, obviously the more urgency there is to get a shot, whereas earlier in the shot clock, there's more urgency to get a quality shot. But when you're saying like which coverages are more efficient, like you have to look at which coverage is better for what period in the shot clock, given that I think we'd all agree a drop coverage is going to allow more shots generally, but they're going to allow lower efficiency shots. Whereas like a blitz is probably going to allow fewer shots, but if it gets beaten, it's going to get beaten with a wide open three or a dunk. So it probably makes more sense to be less aggressive early in the clock when you know they're not going to shoot it as likely because they're going to be more choosy. And then more aggressive later in the clock because they're going to shoot anything. Or not necessarily, obviously, but just a way to think about it. When you say what's efficient and what coverages are efficient, like it's a very, I didn't mean to go down the rabbit hole, but I did. And you can go in a lot of different areas. And I think that's, again, when as a coach, ask a basketball question and then the data person will give you a data answer. Because when you say how efficient is drop coverage, it's like, that's a loaded question. What do you mean? Just some thoughts there that were
rolling around my head. Even that thought, just less aggressive early when they're less likely to shoot it, which is so true, right? So many teams run some masking action to start with where they're not even directly trying to score necessarily. So that makes total sense. And I love that answer. Obviously, again, highlights the complexity of this whole conversation. Maybe from a basketball standpoint, then let's ask a basketball question and then you could answer it from both perspectives because you're a basketball guy and an analytics guy now, and that's awesome. And you always have been. So what's the best way to attack a switch? Easy one.
Who do I got on my team?
Depends, right?
It depends. To avoid the it depends, though, again, just thinking about the complexity of it.
Usually it comes down to one of the things, it inside or do you attack it outside?
So to answer your question, one of the funny things over the last couple of years, I think you'd agree that most people the analytics community views post-ups as inefficient. But actually on a per possession basis, post-ups have been the most efficient action in the NBA. Now, why is that the question? Who posts up? Joel Embiid, Nikola Jokic, LeBron James, Kevin Durant, lesser offensive players don't post up anymore. So does that mean the post is efficient, or is it just means the action is being utilized in its most efficient way? So it's, if I'm going to attack a switch, yeah, then I'm going to post if I have the right player. But in the same way, I'm sure you would teach a guard, if a big's got the ball on the perimeter and he's trying to ISO against a guard, you're going to tell the guard to crawl up into him because he's not going to be able to handle that heat on the ball. You don't want to just let him back you down. Which is more efficient? Who do I have? But understanding that actions aren't efficient, like post-ups and pick and rolls in themselves aren't efficient. It's who's in the actions that dictates efficiency. So to answer, it's a long way of answering, the best way to attack a switch is to have a deep understanding of the efficiencies of your players in certain skill areas. It's not action A, set B, whatever. I would argue it's very personnel dependent.
I love it. And that's really been a big change, I think, at all levels of basketball, is obviously being more personnel dependent than just a scheme or a system that just takes care of those things. Saying that, another basketball question, which you can answer from both perspectives, is what is the value of double teaming a star player? And is that the best way to approach?
Yeah, you're asking the Nikola Jokic question, right? How do you guard him? The answer is you don't. But
yeah, exactly. Like Luka or these different guys, there's no real answer. But given the two, what is your analytics and what does your brain say?
I would say it's about your risk tolerance. So if you guard player A who's really talented in a regular coverage, no double team, you're conceding a certain level of efficiency. Right? Like he's going to be probably pretty good. Whereas if you're going to double him, you're going to have one of two outcomes. One outcome is you play great defense and he's super inefficient, turns the ball over, you get run out dunks, whatever. The second outcome is he picks you apart and instead of giving up 115, you give up 140. So the reward is higher, but the risk is higher. And so you just have to weigh, like, how efficient is this guy? And is it worth it to do that? And then I'm sure, like a lot of the coaches on your podcast talk about, just varying coverages against great players too, right? Like we're talking about these things in long sample sizes, but if you give someone the same coverage over and over again, if we say, hey, on average, the NBA drop coverage is this efficiency, it's this efficiency and this dosage. And the current dosage, let's say, is 50% of the time. But if it was run 90% of the time, it would be a different efficiency. So all of that is you have to factor in. Do you double team players? I think the answer is you do something. I don't know if it's double, but I know just from standing up there and watching great players pick us apart, it's hard to stand there and do nothing. But then it gets back to the early conversation of when you're aggressive in the shot clock, in the game, all of that. How are you aggressive? Are you a coach that you like to structure all of your rotations in a certain way? You like to double team only in certain ways? Or is it, hey, go double the ball and let's fly around? So all those things come into play.
I love your answers. You're stimulating me with a lot of questions that have stuck with me for a while. One of them I've been trying to talk to my daughter about as a 12-year-old AAU player, which maybe we'll get coaches thinking, but the value of trying to recover to a shooter when you can't get there. And when you can't get there, obviously, it depends. But when you can't get, I don't even know what the prescribed rate for second spectrum is for a contested versus uncontested shot, but that type of idea where you can't get to a position because of a rotation, because of a recovery, to a distance where you're actually contesting the shot. I think it was, is it Luke Kornet or who does it for the Boston Celtics where he does that jump in the air type of thing? But I wasn't even thinking that. I was more thinking from the perspective of saying, okay, you're not going to get there, so don't go. Is there been any thought to that?
Yeah. The tricky part with the current data is we don't get what's called pose data, which is where the body is facing and whether the arm's up or the arm's down. So the contests on second spectrum are based on the velocity of the defender, how close he gets, acceleration. And they're estimating that's going to lead to a certain level of contest. But as we all know, when you play basketball, someone runs at you and they don't put their hand up. We can't currently track that. And that's two way different contests. So that's something you'd have to like manually track contests. And I know I just think of it this way. It's just like when you run at someone, you're putting a time clock on them. And when you don't, you're not. So maybe it affects, let's say that situation occurs, a super late contest occurs 7 times a game for 50 games. That's 350 times. If you do it every single time, maybe you cause 5 more misses than you would have. You just saved your team 15 points, which could be the difference between one win and one loss. It's no detail is make or break, but all the details added up are make or break. I don't know if that's helpful.
I don't have an answer for it either, but sometimes I notice that she, for example, not just her, but players go so late. And it's, if you don't go at all, then sometimes that changes the rhythm of the shooter too, where they think they have too much time. And then instead of shooting in rhythm, they actually take too much time. And there's all these complexities of this where I know there's not an answer, but, and obviously the rebounding component as well. And maybe let's go there with rebounding. Is the value of offensive rebounding is constantly in debate, obviously, relative to that. So what are your thoughts right now in terms of offensive rebounding or whatever it may be?
Yeah, the NBA has changed a lot. I think teams have realized the value of the offensive glass. To me, there's several prongs to it. The first, namely, is that there's value in creating half-court possessions defensively versus transition. So if you crash, and even if you don't get the offensive rebound, if you tip the ball around, you're buying teammates time to get back, which is more likely going to lead to half-court possession. You also might tip the ball out of bounds, which means it's going to be a half-court possession. And then there's the added value of you getting the ball when putbacks on offensive rebounds are one of the most efficient shots in basketball. Obviously, dagger threes off of offensive rebounds. It's not that they're efficient because they're off of offensive rebounds. They're efficient because they're wide open catch and shoot threes, which are super efficient. All of that adds up. And then you have to weigh that against the how much worse are you getting hit in transition? We've done a lot of internal study on that. And I apologize for not sharing that. I'll keep that here with us in Orlando. But the league crashes a lot. I'll just say the league crashes a lot more than it used to, just because the net effect of crashing is more positive. Like you add more points on the offensive glass than whatever additional you lose in transition. Of course, I think as a coach, when you think about it psychologically, you have to tell your team that we're going to give up a couple runout dunks. So don't look at us at the bench when we crash 4, the ball gets tipped weirdly, and then they get a 2-on-1 alley-oop. We understand that's going to happen, but we're playing the long game. We think over time, it's going to hurt us. And then just the other psychological factor, you're coaching against Steven Adams. What's the first thing you're saying? Don't leak out, got to box out. So even just the psychological effect of going to the glass means teams are going to leak out less. I think that all adds in the favor of crashing, but obviously the result is you're going to get a game that swings a little bit more violently just because you're getting run outs on both ends a little bit more.
One of the things I get asked the most by NBA people is in the wheelhouse of decision-making, trying to connect it to analytics and stuff like that. And I'll give you a quick example would be the difference between 1 dribble versus 2 dribbles in different situations to be able to, again, create some type of efficiency with that, whether it be decision-making to shoot, decision-making to pass, or obviously to score at the rim. I'm curious, and you can talk in generalities if you can't share specific things, but has there been a lot of work in trying to connect basketball decisions to basketball analytics?
Yes. I would say application to coaching is tricky. I would say it's more been done in the player evaluation space and a front office space, evaluating decisions after the fact. I think how you would apply that data to players in a real coaching setting is difficult. There's a lot of stuff of expected value. If you did this, the value of this possession would have been A. If you did this, the value would have been B, so on and so forth. But I think that's where kind of the skill acquisition space takes a lot more precedent of you building that motor map in your head. So you're able to, in the moment, find the most efficient thing because realistically, it's happening so fast. You're not making a calculation. You're acting off of instinct. How do you build that map so when you get different contextual clues, like you're still finding the most efficient decision? And obviously every coach has it the way you teach that differently, but yeah, that's an area I think that's more an evaluation standpoint, a draft, a free agency kind of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how that'll evolve over time. And for you, like obviously one of your mandates with the G League team is to obviously develop players, particularly around the players that are the two ways and the future possibilities for your roster with Orlando. So I'm curious then, when you have, are you evaluating or are you meeting with players in terms of some of their key performance indicators? Are you doing different meetings with them on a weekly, a monthly basis? And then how are you connecting both the basketball and the analytics together in terms of helping that player understand their future value?
Yeah, we do player development meetings. We have player development plans for all our guys. We established early in the year what we'd be tracking so they knew, and then we present that data to them. But we also tag it all in sports code so we can show the film too. So it's not just here's a bunch of numbers. It's here's what the numbers say. Here's the video. And then let's dive into the video to figure out why X, Y, or Z is happening if we can't get a deeper understanding from the data because we don't have access to it or whatever the reason. Obviously, there are some things that you just can't, that have to be tracked manually or can't be tracked, or at least can't be tracked yet. Yeah, we integrate it in the ways we can. But I think like the conversation we're having, we do not even come close to having a conversation with a player like this, because for us in Orlando and our team, like playing freely is super important, and just being able to play your game and do your thing within certain principles and structures. But we let the data guide how we teach and how we play, but we don't let the data guide individual decisions we make. We think if we create an environment and a structure and a system of play, it will lead to the most efficient shots on the offensive and defensive ends. So it's more, we draw the circle and they color inside the lines.
I love it. Great analogy there. And then not every coach obviously has access to someone like you in terms of helping them interpret the data. So from that perspective, how can coaches best utilize data without becoming overwhelmed or over-reliant on it themselves?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I think it just comes back to very similar principles to what all coaches go through, which is holding people accountable is hard. And the more expectations you have, the harder it is to hold people accountable to those things. So in the same way that it's important to keep your expectations limited so you can hold people truly accountable to fewer expectations, in the same way, when analytics, pick your few things that you really care about. Whether it's we play defense a certain way, we want the low man to be this way, we want our gap help to be this, we guard ball screens this way, whatever. Pick your few things and then track those few things. And it'll be very revealing. If you try to do too much, then it's hard to differentiate signal from noise. And I think it also just backs up your messaging to your team. Hey, we care about A, B, and C. We're going to track A, B, and C. We're going to show it to you on film, and we're going to show it to you with data. And it also, frankly, just becomes manageable for a coaching staff. Our staff in Osceola is 6 people, and obviously high school staffs are even smaller. Some college staffs are smaller. Instead of trying to conquer the whole world, just pick a couple things you like. It'll make it manageable for you. It'll make your message more powerful, and it'll allow you to hold people accountable to those things, as long as you're keeping it consistent across from what you do in practice, games, film, analytics. Like, it should all be driving at the same thing.
Do you have an opinion on hustle stats, which is, again, has been something that's been tracked for a while in different manners, but this kind of concept of connecting effort to the data?
Yeah. Anytime you track something, you're showing that you care about it. Like, you're showing to your team that I care enough about this that I'm having somebody on my coaching staff sit there and watch the film and take a pencil and check it off every time it happens. So however you do that, however you want to incentivize it, I'm a big fan of it. The one thing to be careful though, and I should have mentioned this earlier too, is any tracking, is understanding what behavior you're incentivizing or not incentivizing. You might be incentivizing something that you don't want to be incentivizing. As an example, like if you're going to say, we want to make sure that we're being the most physical team on every box out or whatever. It's like, that sounds good, but the result might be you commit a lot of fouls because you're just slamming into people constantly. Now, if you can live with that, but understand, put yourself in the shoes of a player who sees that incentive and what is their behavior going to be because of that. As long as you're willing to live with that, then that's okay. No tracking structure is ever going to incentivize the behavior you want perfectly. If you're tracking charges, like maybe it doesn't make sense to draw charge every time. Maybe you should go vertical, but you're just going to have guys stepping in constantly trying to draw charges. And instead you get and ones all the time because they're blocks and they're just finishing. So as long as you're thinking through what the result of your incentive structure is, and you're okay with what the potential consequences of it are, then I think it's great. You just have to be aware of that, but nothing you track is going to say what you want. You know, one thing I love, I heard someone say one time, like, the data doesn't say anything. People say things about the data. So the data is only going to track exactly what you tell it to track. What results from that is what people say about it or how they respond to it. But I think that the charges one is a great example, because maybe you have a 6'11 guy who you want to just go vertical every time because he's huge. And now you got him stepping in to draw charges because he wants a free ice cream sundae because he gets 10 charges or whatever. It's like, not what we're going for.
I was definitely exposed to the first concept of this teaching verticality with Stan Van Gundy with the Pistons when I had a chance to watch practices back when he was there, where they did specific drills. And since then, I've seen them at all levels of basketball to a certain extent. But what I'm curious about from that perspective is more some of the teaching points. What are some of the teaching points that you give players in terms of the teaching verticality? And obviously, officials at your level are very good with it. At different levels, they're not as good with it. But in terms of that concept of being able to jump, leave your feet, and stay vertical, can you give us some of the teaching points?
Yeah. So in the NBA specifically, many fouls are committed. They call them A to B fouls. Basically, you jump straight up in the air, but like you're at location A and you jump slightly sideways, A to B. So your arms are straight up and the player says, hey, I was vertical, but you can't jump A to B. You have to literally be in spot A, jump vertical, and land in spot A. If you get hit in the chest when you go vertical and your arms come down and hit them, that's a foul on you. So it's the point being, it's really hard to go vertical legally in the NBA. One of the things that we teach is we want your hands try to touch the back of the rim so your hands don't come flying down and smack the guy in the arms after he hits you in the chest. But another one is if you're not lined up completely, don't go vertical, go block the shot. Because more likely, you're going to try to go vertical when you're late and you're just going to commit an A to B foul. So better to just go try to impact the shot as best you can, whether you're trying to pin it on the glass or whatever. Obviously, you don't want to still foul him, but there is danger in going vertical when you're not in good position. But it also just gets back to what we all preach of you want to be early and help so you can be there on time. But if you're not there on time, going vertical is not always the best idea.
And another thing that stands out, thank you for that, by the way, because I knew it goes beyond just elbows behind ears, which tends to be one of the key teaching points that many people just give. But that's awesome. And then another thing, we see it in the NBA, obviously, because of the gravity of the players on the perimeter, but the decision to help versus not help. Because sometimes in the NBA, clean layups are given up just simply because you're not going to help off of a certain player like you would, say, at the college or high school level. But can you talk to us a little bit about the decision-making process for that player? Is that solely determined based on their ability to get there or not relative to who they're covering? What are some other the parts of the decision-making defensively about whether to help or not?
Yeah, I think if you're there early, if you're pulled over early before the drive happens, then you're not have to make a decision. Like you're already there. So it's when you're late, you have to make decisions. There is no decision. If I'm the low man and there's a drive to driver's right hand from the right slot, I'm right there to trap the box early. So I take two steps and I'm there. But if I'm the low man and I'm guarding the left corner and I'm standing outside the paint on the weak side, and then, oh, there's the drive and now I'm sprinting over. Now I've got to decide, because if I sprint and then the ball handler slings a pass to my guy in the weak side corner, if my helper is not there, that's a butt naked corner three. So then it's like, all right, is this guy a really good finisher? Who's guarding him? You're making all of those decisions in about a tenth of a second. So to me, if you're making decisions defensively like that, like you're already wrong. And then obviously the shooting in the NBA is at such a high level that you get punished if you do that, because the ball gets swung and then drive kick swing and then you're in the blender and it's over pretty much. But back to our earlier conversation, like the rim's the most important thing. Protect the rim first and then trust that your teammates are going to fly around behind you, even if you're late.
And you mentioned this briefly, the concept of scanning, this concept of being able to see both. Again, I grew up with the two pistols mentality of being able to just point at both and see both, but that's not the reality of it. Obviously, you have to be a little bit of a head turner. You have to be active. So can you share some of the kind of teaching points that you would share with a help defender in terms of being able to scan and see both so that their decision is made before the actual action happens?
Yeah, I think super important, obviously, seeing ball in man and keeping everything in front of you. From a teaching perspective, it's, I think, first, offensively, it's why relocating is so powerful, because you move 3 feet to your right, and when your defender turns back to you, he's going to take one step wrong, and that's going to buy you a quarter of a second and get your three ball off. But I think it really comes down to like understanding personnel, being able to anticipate like what this guy's going to do. If I know I'm guarding a shooter, I know that I can lose the vision of him for a second, and then I can just sprint at him with not a lot of consequences. But if I know I'm guarding a driver, if I don't close out with the proper angle on him, like he's going to blow by me, even if I close out short. Understanding just who I'm guarding, where I'm on the floor, I think all of that is super important versus like, you know, when do I look at the ball? When do I not look at the ball? When do I look at my guy? Like we can say, like you said, it's more scanning than you're actually, I'm not just like looking forward, but seeing two ways peripherally. I'm looking one way and then I'm checking every second for my guy. But when or how you do that, that's up to you. To me, it's more important you just know who's out there. So I know like, all right, when I have to make a split second decision, like what's the last thing in my head? Like he's a non-shooter. I'm going short no matter what. Like that to me matters more.
I love it. So many insights throughout this episode. Thank you for sharing some of these details and concepts. And I'm curious from your perspective, again, you've dealt with this for a lot longer than a lot of us have. What are some future kind of trends coming in terms of basketball analytics and how they impact coaches? Is there something that you foresee that in the future that if we had more of this, it would really drive more of this?
Yeah, I go back to that pose data. I think it's super powerful. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of discussion about three-point luck on the value of contests and how much is that actually impacting shots at what distance. When your team is 30th in opponent three-point percentage, is that because you're bad at guarding three-point line or is that because you're unlucky? I think right now it's really hard to know without watching the film deeply and understanding. I think once we get that contest data, like true contest data, I think we'll have a much better sense of really how valuable is it to impact shots in that way. And then what are the most valuable ways to impact shots? Is it a Shane Battier contest with the hand, you know, in front of the face late? Is it, am I trying to high point the ball where like I'm just trying to jump as high as I can, the cornet, and just make them shoot a higher arc? Am I trying to block their vision? Am I trying to block their vision of the basket? Like you get all that pose data, I think can answer a lot of those questions that are super powerful. That's like the next frontier. I know where a lot of the technology is going.
Fascinating stuff, Dylan. And look, I know you've worked hard and you've got this opportunity now to put so many ideas into action as a G League head coach. So talk to us about that experience so far.
Yeah, it's been a really great opportunity. Super lucky. Work for a great coach and Coach Mosley, and to have his support and be able to implement his vision in Osceola has been really cool. And I think the G League is always tricky because you're getting two ways, you're getting assignments, your roster changes every night, the opponent's roster changes every night. Guys are fighting for their careers. We've got a couple of guys on our team that have played in the NBA, have played in big time playoff games. We have a great group in Osceola, super competitive, embrace player development, embrace getting better, embrace being part of our organization. And it's been super cool. And I think just like for any coach who wants to get experience, there isn't a better league than the G League, in my opinion. I started in the G League. The NBA, you're going to be one of a lot of people. In the G, it's just going to be you, a couple coaches, and you're on your grind as much as possible, doing everything. You might be doing laundry one day, and then you have the scout the next day. So it's an all-hands-on-deck situation. Great experience, and so that's why when this opportunity came available, I was excited to jump on it and get back in the G League. But yeah, we're getting ready to make our playoff push here. Second half of the regular season coming up after All-Star. Everyone getting their rest and then we're all systems go.
I love it. So such a great experience for you and such an amazing experience for me and all of our listeners for you to be able to share with us. So thank you so much, Dylan.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show and to give the Basketball Podcast and this week's guest a shout out on social media to show your support for us sharing the game. And to stay up to date on all things Basketball Immersion, subscribe to our newsletter at basketballimmersion.com/newsletter.